Lenore Zan, a.k.a. Rogue.
It's Cal Dodd here, voice of Wolverine from X-Men, the animated series, Bub. I want you to join me at The Uncanny Experience, the ultimate destination for X-Men fans just like you.
Where you will become a mutant student at Xavier's.
And be able to explore the school campus, shop the vendor hall, and meet the creators and stars of the X-Men universe.
There'll be panels, parties, immersive activities all throughout the historic mansion. Whether you're a fan of the comics or the movies or the animated series, you'll find something to love.
This is Chris Claremont. I'm looking forward to seeing you all at the Uncanny Experience.
It's gonna be one hell of a ride, Bob.
I bet it will be uncanny.
Get your tickets now, sugar, at theuncannyexperience.com.
Bum bum bottom, 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 bum bum bottom.
You are now in session with the Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast. I'm Lisa Gullickson.
I'm Brad Gullickson.
And each month we evaluate a different iconic romance within the Four Color Realm. In this episode, we're confronting our nemeses and finding out we've been looking in the mirror the whole time our creator corner, talking to writers Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom about minor threats from Dark Horse Comics.
Lisa.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember, but 8 years ago at the Alamo Drafthouse in Ashburn, Virginia, we attended a screening of Deathbed, the Bed That Eats.
How could I forget?
And Patton Oswalt was in attendance. He was actually hosting it. He was doing kind of like an MST3K run-through of that ridiculous film.
Yes, and you didn't even get the reference because you had not listened to that Patton Oswalt album yet.
No, not at the time, although I have since then. I've listened to all of Patton's albums. Don't worry. Don't worry. Don't pull my nerd card.
He's done the work.
I've done the work. And afterwards, there was this little meet and greet where people could do signings, bring books that they wanted signed, albums and whatnot. And we were doing the In the Mouth of Dorkness podcast, and we were eager to get Patton on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we waited. We actually strategized we should be the last people in line. So we kept letting people go in front of us so we could somehow sneak more time from Patton, as if he would be more generous
right at
the very end of this incredibly long signing line.
In retrospect, a terrible plan.
And we got to the end and we said, Patton, we would love it if you would come onto our show. It's called In the Mouth of Darkness. And Patton, being super gracious, was like, yeah, absolutely. I love that idea. I would love to come and guest. Just get in touch with me and we'll make it happen.
Uh-huh.
And we've done it, gang. 8 years later, we got in touch with Patton Oswalt, and we got him on our show. It's not In the Mouth of Darkness, but Comic Book Couples Counseling, talking about his new series, Minor Threats, that he did with Scott Hepburn and Jordan Bloom, who is also on the show today.
Yes. I was so super nervous that entire screening, anticipating that awkward conversation, because I am such a huge fan of Patton Oswalt. I'm a huge stand-up comedy nerd in general, but like Patton and Comedians of Comedy and his association with that generation that has like Maria Bamford. Like, it's just like, he's just so cool.
The Comedians of Comedy tour was a moment, especially for comic book nerds, because you had people like Patton on there. You had Brian Posehn, Maria Bamford, who I think is your idol.
She is.
And by the way, gang, we're not going to tell the story right now, but Lisa just had a one-on-one comedy session with Maria Bamford.
Yeah.
And also Zach Galifianakis was part of that. Mm-hmm. So like when that was going on, you had to go find that show when it hit your town. You had to watch it when it was airing. All those delicious comic book references, Patton, Brian, they felt like you on stage.
Yeah.
Like they were talking about the stuff that you were in love with.
They were nerd boys made good.
Yeah, yeah. And since then, Patton has just been continuing that trend of making all his nerd dreams come true.
He's writing comics for Dark Horse. He is MODOK. He is showrunning the MODOK show.
Lisa, don't forget about Blade Trinity.
That's right.
He's Puck in Eternals. Spoilers for that mid-credit scene. And yeah, now we have Minor Threats with Jordan Bloom. They took what they did on the MODOK series and with their MODOK comic book, and then they brought it over to Dark Horse Comics, that like vibe.
Mm.
And they made the nerdiest of nerdy comic book series with Minor Threats.
This book is chock full of third degree nerd references. Like, it's not enough to know the thing, but you have to know the thing about the thing underneath a metaphor and a symbol. Not in like a gatekeeper-y kind of way.
No. In a celebratory kind of way. You know, they grew up obsessing over Marvel Comics and DC Comics and having questions about all those relationship dynamics and the narrative possibilities. And they are working out those questions using Minor Threats,
mm-hmm.
which is a run-and-gun, four-issue miniseries. This first chunk, they pack a lot into these four comics. The four comics are available as singles right now, but the new trade paperback will be hitting stores on June 21st, which is in about a month. We realize that. But the books are there right now. You should just get the singles right now and read them. You know, this conversation that we're going to have is not that spoilery. It's here to entice you to get excited about Minor Threats. But I also think that you'll have more fun if you've read the issues.
Right. And then you can read it digitally and then you can buy the physical copy later, which is what we're going to do.
So I figure we can just do a quick read through of the first issue's plot synopsis taken right off of the Dark Horse website. It says this. It's hard out there for a supervillain. Not the world conquerors, chaos engines, or arch nemeses, but the little guys. The ones who put on uniforms, knock out jewelry stores, and get tied to poles. And things are about to get worse. The psychotic Stickman has murdered Kid Dusk, sidekick to Twilight City's premier crime fighter, the Insomniac. The Insomniac's teammates are tearing Twilight apart, turning it into a police state, desperate to capture Stickman and stop the Insomniac from crossing that final line, which he may never come back from. Caught in the middle are the small-time C-list villains, finding it impossible to walk down the street without being harassed by these heroes. With a bounty on the Stickman's head, former villain Playtime decides to assemble a ragtag team of villains to take down the Stickman and kill him themselves.
Ooh, I like the voice at the end.
Thank you.
So Insomniac is like the Batman character and Stickman is the Joker character. So this book is about like, what if Batman goes on this murder rampage because someone kills Damian is the idea.
I mean, it's like what happened to Jason Todd as Robin. You know, mm-hmm. Joker killed Jason Todd. Batman had some problems. So
right.
He had a mental break. And this just takes it like one step too far or one step beyond what DC Comics would be willing to do.
But what the Minor Threats is focused on are those like mid-level villains who are barely surviving on the economy of lesser crimes.
Yeah, the henchmen that you would see in like Batman 66 wearing shirts that read henchmen.
But because the Stickman has done the unfathomable and gone one step too far, their entire existence is under major threat. They have a major threat to their minor existence. And it doesn't seem fair. For those of us who have been living in Gotham for a while now, we have come to understand their entire existence is dependent upon the continuation of this checks and balances of villainy, masked individuals, and crooked cops. Like that is, so by Stickman doing this thing, all of a sudden the entire ecosystem is out of whack.
What's so fun about doing these conversations with creators on Comic Book Couples Counseling is when we start to see themes line up
mm-hmm.
with these conversations. What we start to talk about here with Patton and Jordan perfectly fits snugly next to our conversation that we had with Tom King and Mitch Gerrards last week talking about Batman the Brave and the Bold.
Which goes back to our end of the year Best Comics Gully Awards or whatever we're calling them. What are they called?
The Stampies, Lisa.
The Stampies, yes. I'm only forgetting what they're called because they don't mean anything. They don't matter. But they matter to us. And it goes back to talking about Catwoman, The Lonely City, and yeah. Cliff Chang, which we bring up.
And of course, because we're comic book couples counseling, all these stories are really about reflections and looking inward, and how Minor Threats is really just about Brad and Lisa and everyone else reading it. So yeah, prepare for some of that counseling session goodness with Jordan and Patton. Now, before we get to the actual conversation, we have to do a little words of affirmation.
No, no, no.
For our first-time listeners, and I'm sure we have several first-time listeners with this week's episode.
Welcome.
The words of affirmation are our way to give back to our new and upgrading Patreon subscribers. We curate and use these ourselves, and we're more than happy to pass them on to you. These affirmations are adapted from Batman's own words. Referencing what stories? You'll have to do that research yourself.
Give it a goog.
We don't expect all our listeners to be patrons. Of course, we super appreciate them, obviously. But there are other ways you can support Comic Book Couples Counseling without joining. Write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
Yes, please.
Share this episode with your friends.
Why not?
Share it with your strangers.
Share it with your nemeses. Oh, that's just you in the mirror.
But at the same time, though, consider joining Patreon if you can afford to do so, because we got some really rad content right now. We just did a whole episode, a big time review of the Spider-Verse Burger King value meal.
It's just a Whopper, y'all. Is that a spoiler? I think not. There's still quality stuff in that app.
But we also do a Sleepwalking Through Sandman series where we are going through every single issue of the Neil Gaiman series, one episode at a time, 75 issues, 75 episodes.
Yeah, catch up.
Catch up. Now, we got to get into words of affirmation mindset. We got to like calm and zen ourselves a little
bit
here.
How about a deep breath?
A deep breath. Here we are.
James McCauley. You understand that what defines us is how well we rise after falling.
Derek Keough. You wear a mask, and that mask, it's not to hide who you are, but to create what you are.
Askia Suruma. Sometimes it's the madness that makes us what we are. That's nice.
So you could look at those affirmations as a little silly. You know, we're having fun with Batman. But I like all three of those. I selected them. I especially like that last one about the madness is what makes us what we are. You know, the flaws, our crazy bits. We should also learn to embrace those as well.
In our upcoming conversation, we talk a little bit about our base hunger, like the thing that could make us turn towards villainy. And I think that like Minor Threats is about relating to that hunger in a more healthy and productive way.
Yeah. Oh, okay, that's good. That's enough of a tease. Let's get to our conversation with Patton and Jordan. Jordan and Patton, welcome to Comic Book Couples Counseling. Hello.
Hi.
Hey there.
Welcome to the Love Nest.
Yes, thank you.
It's cozy. We brought out all the candles for you.
That's weird. Oh. That's what we call Patton's office, too, when we're working. But
yes, we call
whenever it two or more nerds are together, it is a love nest.
It is, yes, by definition, a love nest because it's two people who love something and who are now together. So yes, it is a love nest.
So we're celebrating Minor Threats today. We blitzed through the series. Actually, we reread the series this morning.
Oh, wow.
We freaking love what you two are doing with this story. And I would like to start by, oh, you're welcome. I'd like to start with that title, Minor Threats, and focusing on these characters who I believe you've referred to in a Nerdist interview as clock-punching villains. You know,
yes.
Why focus on these clock punchers rather than any other kind of superhero character or trope or whatever. Yeah,
and what makes someone a clock-punching villain versus any other villain?
I think that the difference between like a clock-punching villain and a massive arch-villain, world-conqueror, chaos engine, as Jordan put it, is they're not... They actually are okay with the world as it exists. They just want a little bit of luxury and chill and slack within that world. And they don't know any other way to get that than through crime. They want to rob a jewelry shipment, give the money, get whatever money they can to a fence, go live on that for a few months, relax, vacation, and then pull off another job. A chaos engine is about, I want the oceans to be, made out of cream cheese when I'm done with my cream cheese, right? Like, they literally want the entire world to be different. And these guys are like, I'm not angry with the world. I'm just angry with my lack of bling and drip within this world.
Yeah, they're blue-collar villains who, their only goals are, am I going to have enough money to, pay my alimony and be able to buy a few beers at the end of the day at the local bar? And I think, I think that's... What's interesting about them is they're just trying to better their lives. They're kind of these more tragic characters who life went wrong, and they ended up seeing that the only way out of this life they're stuck in is to throw on a costume, buy a freeze ray, and knock over, some banks. So we thought, we love, crime noir and these kinds of low level criminals, and no one's really kind of focused on these guys in the world of superheroes.
Issue one opens with Frankie meditating on like what her therapist asked her, like, what made you do this? As we get to know her, we find out it comes from like this lack of autonomy. She didn't get to choose her upbringing. She didn't get to choose her talents. She didn't get to choose her circumstances. And I find this to be a tremendously empathetic way to look at a villain. And I'm just wondering, where does this empathy for the villain come from?
I mean, I've just seen a lot in my life, just both personally and then depicted in the kind of media that I enjoy, is that really deep empathy. How much empathy can you have for what seems like the worst people in a society? And when you go back into the stories of why they are the worst people, you'll see that, like you said, it was a constant lack of choice. It was a constant, almost aggressive lack of autonomy. And human beings want beautiful things in their life. They want to feel like they matter. They want to feel like they have a place in the world. And when you keep robbing people of that, they will strike back in what can seem like some pretty extreme ways. It's been really startling in the last 10 years. I think the whole meth epidemic was the first epidemic that started in the Midwest rather than in the cities. So all those decades of people saying, oh, look at minorities, how they always turn to drugs and they always turn to violence. And it's like, well, that's because those groups keep getting opportunities stripped away from them. And lo and behold, in the 90s, once they started stripping away opportunity from the Midwest manufacturing jobs, those people turn to drugs and violence, just like any group will. It is all about lack of hope, lack of autonomy.
One of my favorite things about Minor Threats is how you establish that kind of idea of, what systems are available for these characters. And one of the things in the background that you've created are like these kaijus that have collapsed, decayed, rotted away. And now they're just left there. The superheroes don't remove the corpses. That's not their problem. So we have to build on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, that was... Jordan had this great line where he wanted to have, what does 60 years worth of comic book continuity look like on a city? Whereas in a lot of comic books, there's a state of grace where with each new issue, we just reset. And how about let's have that damage stay there? Let's have the evidence of a massive summer crossover. And then what do people do with it? Huge fallen Jaeger robots and dead kaijus in a poor neighborhood are not going to be the first priority to A-list superheroes, and the residents are going to make do with what's there and try to make it their own. And you see that in a lot of poor neighborhoods, both in urban and rural areas. People will just use what has fallen and is clearly not going to get cleaned up. Just like down in New Orleans after Katrina, there is visible wreckage That people are just trying to do their best to work with.
That idea of, you know, really bringing reality into the superhero world, that's not necessarily a new thing. You know, that's something that we've celebrated a lot. But the two of you, including, you know, with a lot of help from your artist, Scott, have injected a lot of humor with that sort of deep emotion that really gets to Lisa's joy. Can you talk about the balance between, you know, the humor and the reality and the superherodom of it all?
I think humor is a very, very big part of reality, especially when reality starts getting harsh. People will turn to kind of a gallows humor and a kind of a rat-a-tat joke thing to keep away the kind of the all too much overbearing reality of your situation, of your lack of hope, of the fact that violence is just always there. You know, you see that a lot. And it's why a lot of the so-called harshest gangster hip hop has an amazingly dark sense of humor to it. Some of the lyrics, especially from people like Boots Riley. And if you listen to the Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die, as dark of a saga as it is peppered with genuinely funny jokes, very dark jokes, very harsh jokes. But he's capturing the kind of coping mechanism that I think a lot of people in that situation just, you have to rely on that. It's the only way to keep from going insane.
I love that you brought up Boots Riley. We were just talking about Boots Riley in conversation with another comic book called Justice Warriors that Matt Boers and Ben Clarkson did for Ahoy Comics, which we freaking loved. But it, you know, it is amazing how these satires, you know, your comic included, as funny as they are, they cut so deep. I mean, they're painful.
Yeah. I mean, again, we're just building on what Stan Lee and Joe Simon and Jack Kirby did, which was superpowers are not necessarily going to make your life or your world better, your immediate world better, unless you can find a way to apply them. And a lot of times they can end up being a curse. And a lot of times there's that, I think a lot of people have dealt with this where, oh, if I could just be rich and famous, I'd be okay. But it's like, but you'd still be yourself. Like, you still have to solve the problems of yourself. The money and the fame will take care of some problems, but you'll still have deeper things that'll eat you alive if you don't confront them and deal with them.
I love how you have structured Minor Threats, where we actually get to spend like quality time with each of the members of this little like villain family.
Right.
And you discover that each of them has had this like back against the wall moment where they make a choice to feed like this deep relatable need. Like, so for Frankie, it's like that familial love, or with Scalpel, it's like financial security. I wonder if we looked into Stickman's past, would he also have like this deeply relatable hunger?
Maybe, but we want to keep figures like the Insomniac and the Stickman. They are so massive, and we wanted them to represent those figures in life. There are certain figures in life that are so massive and monstrous that you're going to have to accept that their experience actually goes beyond what you can maybe comprehend, and their reaction to said experience goes beyond what you can comprehend as a human being. You know, I think that people like a Donald Trump or a Ted Bundy are just examples of people that have reacted to, you choose how you react to things, and they chose the most absolutely monstrous way to react to, you know, life dealing them some pretty harsh and awful stuff. Some, you know, Churchill and Hitler had very similar backgrounds. Churchill decided to react to it a certain way. And Hitler reacted to it a certain way. And Churchill, by the way, still had some pretty monstrous qualities about himself. Yeah. Keep that in mind. A lot of times the most massive figures in our history, in our culture are that way because they have decided to live monstrously. And you never get the whole story about them. So we'll never tell, I don't think we'll ever tell the whole story of the Stickman or the Insomniac or figures like that.
Minor Threat scratches this intellectual itch of mine, which is like, I think that Batman is like the worst thing to have ever happened to Gotham City. And now, like,
you absolutely argue that.
Yeah, because we see it in Cliff Chang's Catwoman Lonely City, where even
oh my
after
God, was that
so good.
It was
good.
So friggin' good. Oh, I love it.
When Batman is moved from Gotham, it creates this power vacuum where something else as large gets sucked into that place. And everybody's trying to continue the status quo as if Batman still exists.
It's really interesting. There's a throwaway line in either season two or season three of The Wire where, you know, they want to take down Avon Barksdale, this massive drug kingpin. And without anyone saying it directly, although they hint at it, they're like, Avon Barksdale is this massive criminal overlord. But once we remove him, it's going to be the wild, wild west. Mm-hmm. People are going to be fighting to see who gets the new crown. And in a weird way, because he's such a professional, he weirdly is keeping the murders down. Like, yes, he just murdered two people, but if we remove him, 20 people are going to die. There's going to be bodies everywhere. Like there's that weird, going back to the Old West, where towns would give the Earp brothers, who were not lawmen, they were violent psychopaths, they would give them a cut of the pharaoh and the prostitution to keep everyone else in line.
Pointing out the fact that, like, Batman is barely not a supervillain. Just yes. Barely. Like, that's why Damian Wayne is my favorite Robin, because... Yeah. By the existence of Batman having a child and having a shift in priorities, we are all threatened because that's how large he is.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's the vigilante thing of just like, it's a very fine line between you preventing crime and just beating up poor people because you think they might be criminals or you're not really solved. There's systemic issues that you're not addressing. So you're just taking it out on people who have no other choice but to kind of survive. So yes, I agree.
I mean, there's a reason that line at the end of the Blue Beetle trailer really resonated when George Lopez said, Batman's a fascist. And everyone's like, wait, is he? And people are like, yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Totally. Kind of about him.
Well, I think the Batman stuff works best when it's like the Joker's, you know, poison the Gotham reservoirs. It's like, yeah, that's what you should be handling. But I think like the cold open purse snatcher is rough. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because that we now know enough about the world to know that a purse snatcher is coming at it from desperation and hunger. Mm-hmm. He is not a supervillain rubbing his hands together in a high rise penthouse. He probably can't afford Pampers and formula, and God knows why he's out there, and it's terrifying. He's just as scared as his victims.
One of the frustrations, like as a comics reader, sometimes when we're at when our love tanks are low and we're like at our base level, we go like, we hate the constant status quoing of superhero universes. Like, why does everything have to be like set back to the status quo? And like, yep. Minor Threats points out, like, we are all actually living in a status quo. Like, we have our 1% that is like living off of poverty, and we're afraid to dismantle them because we don't want to start our universe over, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the thing of like, well, this is the power structure that I'm familiar with, even though it sucks for me. I at least know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. If we bring in someone new, I don't know what the rules are. That's why you see so many, I think it's why you see so many poor people or bad off people defending Trump, defending the GOP, because yeah, they're fucking them over, but at least they know how they're going to get fucked. There's no surprises. And they will, sometimes people will live under a bad structure as long as there's no surprises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we wanted to kind of play with that with Frankie, where, you know, the book opens with her, right, resenting this life, resenting this place she's stuck, literally this part of town, Redport, that she's known her whole life. But I think there's also, with supervillainty, a sense of pride, like, do I want to escape this place or do I want to make it better? Can this life be better? And I think she starts to play with these ideas. Can supervillainty be done better? And that's sort of, you know, where we wanted to end up with her, is not just, do I run away from this or do I fix this? Because this is home.
Like, the way I interpret Frankie's arc is that her back against the wall moment was Maggie saying, get away from me. You're frightening me. Where I feel like if she had not directly suffered the rejection of her daughter, she wouldn't have turned back to that life of crime.
Yeah, that's definitely the big inciting incident, is sort of like what
her husband says, which is like, you'll never be done with this. And this life will never be done with you, no matter how hard you're trying.
Yeah.
It's going to follow you. And we don't want your daughter to be a part of it. So she's kind of given this choice, right? Like, you have to figure out a way to escape this, to leave it behind if you want to be a mother, if you want to have this daughter. And I think what we try to do over the course of the series is, I love characters who are like, well, I want it all. Why can't I be this mother? And why can't I also be this kingpin, you know, who unites supervillains? And, you know, I love that duality, right, of the character, where these wants conflict with each other, but it's very hard for a character like Frankie to say, I'm going to give it all up, or I'm going to have to choose one side or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the fatal flaw of so many characters is, no, I don't want to have to make a choice. I should be allowed to have everything I want. And that always leads to disaster.
It's very American.
It is very American. You're right. So American.
But like, brain tease, I relate to deeply, because I'm like, you know what? I want to be recognized for my talents. I want to be seen as special. Like, I feel like I meet a character like Brain Tease and I go like, okay, what would be the thing that would turn me to a supervillain? You know, like, what is my base hunger that will make me, will turn me? Like, do you think about that for yourselves? Like, what is my most toxic hunger or need?
I especially was looking at a lot of myself in some of these characters and looking at some of the ways that I've kind of gone, not aberrant, but like, oh, you know what, that does get to me. And that is a personal ego thing that I'm not, you know, instead of shying away from it, which makes two problems, you go, yeah, you know, that's a problem I have. I got to work on that.
Yeah. I feel like Brain Tease became weirdly one of the more relatable characters when we were writing it. Cause it's a guy who, you know, knows that he has something inside of him, this potential, but he can't get out of his own way. And he keeps self-sabotaging himself in a way. Like, he's his own worst enemy, and any kind of traction he gets, he screws it up. So we kind of were like, well, that's relatable for a guy who wears a brain helmet and likes to create puzzles.
Yeah.
Rob Bell, through Brené Brown, I got a quote from Rob Bell, which is that despair is thinking that tomorrow is going to be the same as today. And I think each of these villains is despairing in one way or another. Like, tomorrow I'm not going to have my daughter. Tomorrow I'm not going to be seen for my talents. Tomorrow I might not have my financial security. And I think it goes back to like what we were talking about earlier of like, oh, well, you know, if their circumstances were slightly better and they had more options, maybe they would be heroes.
Yeah. Or successful. Even,
right. You know, successful, like, supervillains.
Yeah.
It's weird that you bring up despair, because I read a quote from Sergio Aragonés years ago where he talked about someone asking me, you always draw superheroes kind of flabby and silly, and you're kind of always making fun of me. He's like, well, to me, superheroes represent despair. Mm. Superheroes represent, I can't handle my life. I want something with a magic ring to come out of the clouds and fix everything. I can't handle it. Like, there is a despair element to that. And I've always remembered that. So there's, you know, this is just despair, but from the ground up.
What we tried to do is kind of show what you're talking about with Frankie, in that she's kind of always done things her mom's way. And there's a way supervillainy is done. And she's always had this other life pulling at her. And I think over the course of the series, she starts to realize she's actually pretty good at this, especially when she does things her way, which is sort of merging this new darker world that's kind of encroaching with the kind of glory days of the way her mom and Pigeon Pete did stuff. So it's kind of this fusion of the old way and the new way will become my way. And maybe I can be more than just this petty criminal. Maybe we can build something real here if I take the lead and I step up in a way I haven't.
Often, like, heroes are seen to be like, okay, you have to make this sacrifice. You have to do like this selfless thing. And if you reach this level of selflessness, you will become a superhero. But then we have characters like Insomniac, characters like Batman. Or if you look at it from another angle, it's actually profound selfishness.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. Yeah, it is this, because there is, even though they would never say it out loud, there's this unspoken, well, I guess I have to stand up and fix everything because everyone else is incompetent. Mm-hmm. And there's that, there's a passive aggressive wanting that credit. I mean, that was one thing I was really pleased with after Frank Miller did The Dark Knight Returns. A lot of the subsequent writers who handled Batman really did lean into the fact that he is kind of judgmental and really wants to show everybody up and be the smartest one in the room and be the strongest one in the room. And there was always that unspoken, like, yeah, well, of course the Green Lantern's so powerful because someone gave, I don't need a ring to do that. Like, there is that kind of douchey jock bro aspect to him that some people haven't leaned away from. And it makes him, I think, a richer character.
It's a fine line, right, between one man can make a difference and I'm the only one who really knows how to fix this.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Without spoiling too much about where Minor Threats leaves off these characters, there is a power shift at the end of this book. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious as to where these characters go now that that power shift has occurred.
There's a vacuum in Twilight City.
Yep. And that vacuum is in a accurate world, that vacuum would begin to be fought over.
Okay. Yeah,
I think I'll be getting answers to that soon. Okay. We were curious too.
Yeah. All right. I like hearing that. You know, we've been pretty darn serious in this conversation so far, being very comic book couples counseling about everything, exploring the intensity and the reality of these comics. But I do want to geek out just a little bit about the formation of this group in particular. You know, when you set out to create this Suicide Squad of characters, which templates did you immediately know you wanted to put into the book, and which one sort of just bubbled out of necessity?
Well, I mean, you name the Suicide Squad, which that run on that in the 80s and 90s is still friggin' brilliant and so ahead of its time. So ahead of its time. Obviously, also Astro City was a huge influence on me. That was a revelation when I first read it. Jordan, you had some other ones as well that you really liked?
I think the big ones for me were the Flash's rogues are such a template for the blue-collar villains. And then, you know, Spider-Man's villains. And then I think the biggest one is not just Batman's villains, but the way the Batman villains were written in Batman the Animated Series, which is all about the tragedy, right, of these characters. And so that was our thinking, was we wanted to, you know, this is Frankie's story. You're going to be introduced to her. You're going to see it through her eyes. And everyone else is going to kind of jump on board with this suicide mission for their own reasons that we'll learn about later. And that gave us a chance to kind of flesh each character out by shifting narrators each issue. But we knew, you know, you got to have the muscle. You got to kind of have the femme fatale. You know, we were definitely pulling from some familiar archetypes, but it's like, who's going to balance out this team? And then also, what are the personalities that are going to clash immediately? Because these are villains. They should not get along. This is not a well-oiled machine.
I also, it's weird that you mentioned the Spider-Man villains, because I really, and they're doing a lot of that now with the contemporary Spider-Man, where the Spider-Man villains, much like Spider-Man, are very, very open about, I'm just doing this as a, they're paying me to do this right now. This guy is paying me to be muscle. If you want to pay me more, I won't do it. Like, they're very open about, this is the financial need that's leading me to do this. And they're just, and same with in Batman's Rogues Gallery, I really love the character of the Penguin, only because they've really kind of broadened him, where he's like, hey, Batman, you could put me in jail, or you could keep me out on the street running the Iceberg Lounge, where I overhear a lot of shit. And so how strict are you with your whole, there is good and there's evil? I mean, is it really black and white with you, or are you willing to work in the gray? Like, there's those kind of characters to me are really, really intriguing.
Also, you in Minor Threats, you celebrate like different eras of comics, which gets reflected in the art. It gets reflected in the characterization. And I just wonder if, like, you have a comics sweet spot, like an era of comics that you return to constantly, or do you like to look at comic books as this large continuum and a layer cake with all a bunch of different flavors?
I think this story was born out of, like, what happens to all the goofy Bronze Age characters that we sort of love, the one and dones, you know, from Spider-Man that would just show up because they just needed a new villain of the month. When, you know, Frank Miller does The Dark Knight, or, you know, Alan Moore does Watchmen, and suddenly things are darker and death in a family and all the stuff's happening. And these guys who are kind of remnants from this period get dragged in, like, what? Batman's doing this now? You know, like,
yeah,
what happened? What happened to the good old days? And we really wanted that thematically to be a part of some, like, a weird meta level of, like, yeah, what happens to the goofy Silver Age guys when all of a sudden the world changes because of the creators behind it?
Yeah, there's something really, I'm torn back and forth all the time when you say sweet spot between, I love the grim and gritty 80s. That's really what got me back into comics. It's like when you're looking at new wave bands and hair metal bands in the early to mid 80s, you're like, you don't know that grunge and hip hop and gangster rap is coming for you. And so it makes them weirdly, at the time, it seemed like it was the edgy stuff. And now it's like, oh, this is adorable and kind of poignant. Like, you don't know what's coming. So that kind of stuff, oh, I love the shifting of eras and then who survives after the shift. And there's just, I don't know. There's something really poignant and human about that.
That's why I think for me, the sweet spot is the 90s, because you get people like Grant Morrison who fuse modern, darker storytelling with the goofiest, craziest comic book stuff, you know, from the Silver Age and Bronze Age. And that's my favorite thing, is when you take the silly seriously, but you don't try to darken it too much or ground it too much. You embrace the absurdity of comics, I guess, is my sweet spot.
Yeah, like, I feel like that era really leading up to now is kind of like new Hollywood, right? Where all these people who had consumed all this entertainment, you know, in the 40s and the 50s have now brought this modern energy to it. And I feel like, you know, my sweet spot right now is now. Comics are so good.
But like you brought up Grant Morrison. Like, what makes Grant Morrison so wonderful is that they're brilliant, first and foremost. But two, that reverence is there. That reverence for the medium. Yes. And I feel like that reverence for the medium is also in Minor Threats.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird how you mentioned new Hollywood of the 70s, because the line on them was like, these new people are coming to tear the studio system down. All those directors loved old Hollywood, loved it, they wanted studio contracts, but the studios collapsed. They didn't tear it down. It was the only way they could make films. But if you look at, like, you know, The Godfather, there's Richard Conte and Sterling Hayden, because Coppola was like, my God, and friggin' Brando, the studio didn't want Brando. They're like, that guy's all washed up. All these young people wanted the classic Hollywood in their film.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that I think, you know, I love all the 80s stuff with Frank Miller and Alan Moore as well, but I feel like the wrong lessons were taken from those. Mm-hmm. And I think that led to some of the bad comics of the 90s, where, like, everything has to be grim and gritty and there's no room for silliness. Superheroes need to be serious. And I think we wanted to kind of shy away from that as possible. Where it's like, we want you to care. We want you to feel that the stakes are real for these characters, but also we want dead kaijus in the background and time warps and all the things that you can only do in comics. And comics should be fun, you know, even though this is a darker story, it should be an adventure as well. And I think that's always been a goal of ours.
That's what I want to talk about before we get out of here, is, you know, you have worked in multiple mediums and you have now dipped into comics, you know, with your MODOK series, which we really, really loved, and now with Minor Threat. But what does the medium offer you that you don't get elsewhere?
A limitless creativity and no budgets. And, you know, you can do whatever you want. And I think also, too, you know, Pat and I are known as comedy guys. And I think people love to kind of say, well, that's what they do, you know.
Right.
And it was funny because I think when Marvel offered us that MODOK series, I don't know if they were expecting us to make it as silly as the show, but we were like, no, we want to tell a tragic, sad story about MODOK that feels like the Marvel Universe MODOK, who is not as goofy or silly as the version in our comedy show. So I think people always were expecting even, I think, Minor Threats to be maybe funnier, or we'd be making fun of these characters, or, you know, but we were like, no, we want you to feel for them. So I think it was for us to flex maybe slightly more dramatic muscle than have been allowed to previously, or what people want to defy the expectations. We rarely ever want to do the same thing over and over again.
Also, it's never effective when you're making fun of something that you hate. Yeah, it's always more effective when you make a parody of something that you actually love. But when you love something, you can't help but go, I love this, but why do they do this one stupid, you know, and that will create way more startling comedy. It's why the robot chicken stuff is so good. They're not going, Star Wars Marvel sucks. They love it. But there's things about it that even people who love it are like, can we at least acknowledge how dumb this is?
Yeah, absolutely. We used the word earlier about Minor Threats as a celebration, and Minor Threats does feel like a celebration for as painfully real and recognizably human as it can be.
Well, I think the other thing, we haven't talked at all about Scott Hepburn, our artist.
Yeah.
Right.
What's different about this for us is Scott, and we love writing for Scott and trying to push him in the medium as much as we can, because he can draw anything and he's wants the challenge. So the idea of how do you think about a scene differently than you would if you were writing it on a show, you know, or in a movie. And like, I think a good example is that scene where reptilians laid out on the table and they're like, what happened? And they're talking about, you know, what went down with the Insomniac, and the idea of like, we know Scott can draw the hell out of this. Let's do these little insets that just give hints of this fight. And, you know, it's giving him the bare bones of like maybe something like this, and then him cooking something up that's so much better than what we could have ever imagined and pushing it even further.
There are characters he has put just hanging out in the background that we're now like, well, we got to write a story for that guy. That's so awesome. Like the way he populates the world leads us to more creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was really him who came up with the idea of like, well, what is a world that's kind of weathered 60 years of superhero continuity look like if it just, you know, they don't clean everything up, especially in the bad side of town, this part that's kind of has that economic despair, you know, they wouldn't even bother. And I think a lot of the world building came from Scott and these conversations. I think once he started talking about that, it really clicked into place, like, oh, we're going to do the Warriors, but they have to get across a city that has all of these leftover superhero stories that were never cleaned up. And we're not even going to explain half of them, but they're going to run into it along the way.
One of the funnest things about being in a new universe is that you know that everything is new for your eyes too. Like sometimes it can feel like, you know, like you're reading an X-Men book, and you're like, oh, everybody else knows how to name every single one of these people. You know what I mean? it's like curiosity killing, you know, where like you look in that character in the background now ignites your imagination because you know that you can't just go online and like,
there's
Google
no
it.
Husband next to you to go like, well, actually that character first appeared in.
Aww.
We wanted to do something new, but we felt like the beauty of comics is the audience sort of speaks the language. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to go, oh, you see those shells of a plant up there? Well, that was when Poison Ivy struck in Batman. You know, it's like, oh yeah, of course there's just dead man-eating plants in the background because it's a superhero universe. That stuff happens. You know, like there's a shorthand you can use where you don't need to do as much, you know, like I said, hand-holding as you would in other mediums.
But that's what I love about Scott's art is like, it's so like every page is just so dense. Like you realize that you can go back to that page and there are 10 things you missed.
Yeah. He's such a storyteller. Yeah. And you know, to us, that's the best part of it is getting these pages back. We're like, what's that? That's amazing. Who's this person? I want to write this spinoff.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We're so excited for the trade paperback to come out and for more people to pick it up. You know, we enjoyed the book as a monthly, but when you read it all at once in a trade format with a nice thick spine, like it just has this different emotional effect.
The constellations come together. Like you can actually look at all of the stars like together and you go like, okay, I see the picture now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can especially get the flow of the story because this all pretty much happens in one night. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get the, I think reading it all together, it's going to have a different pace and velocity to it because the, we really kept reminding ourselves of how under the gun these characters are. And it leads them to make, they're capable of making some really dumb decisions. Like anyone is under these circumstances.
Well, Jordan Patton, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. Before you get out of here, I'm sure people know where to find you, but just in case they don't read my show notes that I torture myself over every episode, can you direct them to where they can continue this conversation with you online?
Twitter and Instagram at Patton Oswalt and PattonOswalt.com.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram as well as at Bloom Jordan.
Gentlemen, this has been an absolute pleasure. Minor Threats, everyone listening, go buy it.
Buy it twice like we will.
Yes. Buy four copies. And then one for each issue, and then you can lay them all out. And well, you want the one copy to read. You want the one copy to put in plastic. You want the display one you can put on your shelf. And then just a fourth one in case of an apocalypse.
Or to lend out. I'm always lending out my graphic novels. I'm never getting them back. You know you're going
to lend out
never
copy.
Get them back. Yeah.
We don't have any lending copies.
No.
There you go.
We don't
do that.
That's
not how we roll.
Yeah. Gentlemen, have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Much. Bye, guys.
And there you have it. Once again, Minor Threats is currently available, all single issues, 1 through 4, both physically and digitally. But the trade paperback will hit shelves on June 21st. Lisa, the part in that conversation that really resonated with me this go around while I was editing it was that bit that you brought up, talking about how all of us have different types of people within us. Mm-hmm. We're capable of good. We're capable of bad. We're capable of so many things.
We're capable of contradicting ourselves.
Yes.
Like, I always find myself going back to that Walt Whitman quote from Leaves of Grass. Like, we all contain multitudes.
Yes.
And, like, we tend to give certain characters more dimensionality than others. Like, we think about Batman, like, oh yeah, you know, he was hurt as a kid and that gives him permission to be, oh, and he's super rich. So that gives him permission to walk the line of hero and villain, where we are all walking that line all of the time.
Yeah, and it's a conversation that we recently had in our Sleepwalking Through Sandman episode, talking about Thessaly / Larissa, mm-hmm. and how we were not necessarily willing to give her the latitude that we were also giving Morpheus,
right?
Simply because he was the lead character, but Morpheus also has done a lot of heinous stuff in his time.
Mm-hmm.
So why shouldn't we forgive Larissa Thessaly the way that we kind of forgive Morpheus?
Or excuse. We feel really super comfortable damning someone we have no context for. But the second we know an individual's story, we go, oh, okay, there are shades of meaning to what they're doing.
Which is what Minor Threats does.
Right.
It looks to the henchmen and gives us, the readers, their context.
So, like, how I want to learn and grow from Minor Threats is just to just presume that there is always context. We have so little control on the grand scheme of things over who we become.
We've talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again, but when you're in your car and you're driving around and someone cuts you off, you get so mad. You're like, oh, how dare they?
I would never be the type of person to cut someone off.
Right. But we don't know what's going on inside that car. And because we don't know what's going on inside that car, it's so easy for us to say, screw you.
Yes. And when we see strangers judging us, where we see someone, like, we do something a little derpy in our car, and we see someone judge us, we go, you don't know me!
How dare you!
I am a complicated person!
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what comics like Minor Threats give us. They give us the opportunity to think about the others that are floating around outside our context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I also just want more Minor Threats comics, so I need every everyone listening to not only buy the singles, but to buy that trade when it comes out in, on the 21st of
yes,
June.
Please.
Because I need that sequel ASAP. Four issues. So much is being jammed into these four issues. I need more space to breathe the aromas of Twilight City.
And it, Twilight City is so densely populated yeah. with like really interesting individuals.
A lot of context to explore.
A lot because of Scott Hepburn and the art and how much story he crams into every single panel.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really gorgeous and dense comic book. Our favorite kinds of comic books. Mm-hmm. So thank you for hanging out with us and Patton and Jordan and bringing a little Minor Threats into your lives this day. We appreciate it. And again, please consider sharing this episode with a friend. Consider sharing this episode on your socials. It really helps the podcast a lot. And, you know, a 5-star review mm-hmm. that goes really far in podcast land. So please consider that as well.
And if you choose to subscribe to us, we have a lot more fun stuff coming down the pike.
Yes, we do. Our next Invincible counseling session with Mark and Eve, the Robert Kirkman, Corey Walker, Ryan Ottley characters, is right around the bend. We're 3 episodes into their session, and we are covering Invincible Full House, which is very close to the end of Invincible, a really chaotic and extremely violent time. And boy, it stirred up some feelings in Lisa. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to having that conversation and releasing that episode. And of course, we're going to conclude our Mark and Eve counseling sessions with the last 2 Invincible trade paperbacks, The End of All Things. And Lisa has no idea how Invincible concludes.
I don't.
And I cannot wait for her to discover that joy? Question mark? We got more creator conversations in the future as well. We just booked somebody that
I'm super excited about.
Lisa, this is such a Lisa guest. And I want to announce it, but also we haven't had the conversation yet, so I'm wary to announce
it. Yeah, you don't want to upset the can gods.
But yeah, just cross your fingers for us and get happy as well. And I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. That's what we got going on with Comic Book Couples Counseling right now.
Yeah. So, Brad.
Yes?
I'm thinking right after this, I'm going to start my life of crime. I think now is the time.
You do contain multitudes, I hear.
I do.
Multitudes. That's
the word. Right. That's
yeah,
the word.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't read Leaves of Grass, Lisa. I'm sorry.
You only have to know that quote.
Okay.
Where can our listeners send the words of affirmation to you?
You can find me on all social medias at MouthDork. If you have words of affirmation for our logo, you can send them to Aaron Prescott at A Cool Hand Fluke. And if you have some words of affirmation for our Radical banner art and show posters, send them to Karen Charm at Karen_X-Men Fan. Lisa, where can our listeners send the words of affirmation to you?
I'm always accepting words of affirmation at Sidewalk Siren on Instagram and Twitter. If you'd like to spend more quality time with us, you can subscribe to us on Podbean, Stitcher, YouTube, Google, and Apple Podcasts. Are we going to edit that out? Can I do that again?
It's up to you.
Is anybody grossed out? I'm a human being.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. If you'd like to get exclusive, woo, you can join our Patreon, where you'll get more content, including weekly bonus episodes.
If you'd like to reach out and touch us electronically, you can email the podcast, cbccpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit our website, comicbookcouplescounseling.com, or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at cbccpodcast. Your turn.
Uh-huh. You can give us the gift of 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, and if you'd like to do an act of service, why not write a review of the show while you're there?
Yes, please.
We are fluent and receptive in all 5 love languages. It really warms our hearts and helps the pod.
But we're super nerdy and needy for words of affirmation.
That's
clearly
true. That's true.
So until next time, friends, keep your love tank full.
And your psychic rapport open. Doopy-doopy-doo. The stick man has done the unfathomable. That's hard to say.